Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. I'm Floodman11, and today we're going to be talking about the ELMS race at the Red Bull Ring, along with previewing the ELMS and WEC doubleheader at Silverstone. But first, before we get into that, we had quite a large GT3 race recently, of course, being the 24 Hours of Spa-Francorchamps, the premier event of the Blank Pan Endurance Series. And to talk to you a bit more about that, we have Cookie Monster FL giving us a full wrap-up and rundown of the event. Let's hear what he had to say.
Thanks, Flood. The 2018 Spa 24 Hours at Spa-Francorchamps had everything from close competition, spills and thrills, to a first-time winner. To me, it's one of the four majors of the 24-hour events throughout the calendar year, being Nürburgring, Le Mans, Daytona 24, and obviously the Spa 24. Drivers had said that this race, outside of all, is probably the most competitive just because it has so many in the pro or overall category that can win. Out of the 65 cars that compete every for this event, 30 of them are in the pro class, meaning that there's almost around 100, over 100 pro drivers and 30 pro lineups that have a shot to win overall. Driver readiness and even the driver discipline was a factor in this race, as it usually is at Spa, and it always is a talking point, especially off tracks and incidents. This year was no exception. Many different gaffes that were had on track, even in the pits, and sometimes some amateur driving, but overall, it was a fairly calm race weather-wise, so we didn't have a whole lot of that. So the drivers really had the opportunity and max grip, and utilized much more at times than they needed. The Spa 24 features a Pro and Pro-Am categories, featuring GT3 runners. And realistically, that means that even a Pro-Am, if they get enough opportunity, could maybe potentially mix it up in the overall field, but usually you will see a class distinction between the pro category and the pro-am. Usually the pro is very much more like a factory-backed effort, so the lap times are more consistent and they're just quick. Usually you'll see even the newer equipment in the pro category. So while there is the opportunity for pro-am to win, usually we'll see the pros take that. To start off, Aston Martin grabbed pole in the 62, with the Audi on the outside of the front row. Aston Martin set the pace early, and that was clear. Even though the Audi got the advantage at the start, the Aston Martin showed decent pace early on, and I feel like we've seen this before too with Aston Martin. They just haven't been able to consistently stay through, the pointy end of the field, I should say. And you'll see that kind of come into play later on. But, the fast, there is so many different manufacturers that have just basically had their moments to shine. 13 manufacturers in total this year. A real big plethora of just different types of cars, from mid-engines, front engines, and a sort of rear engines, if we want to consider Porsche still that. So Bentley, unfortunately, though, with their brand new Continentals, one of them starting from the pits. So while you have the success of British make at the front of the field, off to on the back foot comes the Bentley as well. Punctures and off tracks were really a big deal. We saw a lot of off tracks that usually happen most often, but for this event, we saw a lot of punishment for that. A lot of punctures and a lot of spins even too. Even some contact with the wall as well. So as much as I would say in other races, we've seen just off tracks resulting in time penalties and self-inflicted punishment. The track was doling out a lot of it this time, I feel like, for this race. And so you saw a lot of safety cars, some full course yellows, that kind of thing. And that really bunched the field up in turns, and which, as we say almost in the United States, cautions breed cautions, especially for some of the oval racing. So, and that was a storyline that I think came to play throughout the entire race, as we'll get into it later on. The Pro-Am category had a familiar name to a lot of people. Chris Harris, driving in the McLaren, led early there as well. So you saw a lot of British success coming very early. While that would continue, it wouldn't necessarily be with the same players. The Aston continued, as I said, to lead overall well for the good 2 to 3 hours, and basically handed off then to the Bentley as it basically led into the night. And again, we still saw lots of spins, but as well, we saw some loose wheels, and we saw WRT Audi have an issue having, I think, the left rear wheel not stay attached on an outlap, and it unfortunately had to retire simply because it couldn't make it back to the pits, which unfortunately for them resulted just in a terrible finish. We also saw Grasser Racing's Lambo have some contact coming off, coming back to green in the bus stop, and suffered significant damage to the front right, had significant repairs, and also received, adding insult to injury, a time penalty as well. Not to be outdone with problems, Straka Racing also had their Mercedes with, I believe, a front left issue or front left damage, which also had to be significantly repaired as well. Bentley troubles on one side of the pit, where they had some contact and they had some I believe a steering arm issue went bad later, but that was only after contact with another car. However, the other car, the sister car, was leading still through the night, in which we featured a blood moon. So everything basically that would come to fruition later on was surmised to be because of this celestial event, unfortunately. But it looked incredible in some of the back shots, so I'll definitely give it that. And as we see the shots of the blood moon throughout the night, the number 8 Bentley suffers that steering arm failure and unfortunately has to pit for repairs, so it falls out of the lead due to contact with the number, I believe it's the 88 Ferrari that it makes contact with. So unfortunately, Bentley was looking in a sense, control the race. I mean, they had come through the field, with their car that started in the back. Both of the cars, even if they were in, they had some delays and issues, they still fought right back up in the top 10. That was definitely one of the contenders of the race, nearing the halfway point for me. And even still after these issues, the number 7, I believe, still was able to stay in contention. But this kind of really ended the number 8's potential to get a podium finish or really win the race, unfortunately. So, and it's just a bummer to see Bentley every year kind of have these slight hiccups that don't keep them in contention. I would just really like to see them get a top 5 finish, maybe not win it, but just be close at the end where that they are one of the guys, one of the players at the end of the race to get it done. So we'll keep talking more about Bentley because they're still, they'll still stay in it throughout this race, but just unfortunate to see these like kind of just slight errors and just affect their race every single year almost, it seems like. I'm really pulled for them to get a good result one of these days, so. To top off the night racing, though, we had some spectacular crashes. The first one involving the Lexus of Stefano Telli. This was at Eau Rouge, and this was a big off. And actually, I missed it live by probably, I think, 5 minutes. There was an onboard shot, basically, or an onboard stream that they had of the Lexus. And I think I had gone to get something to eat, and I had come back, and basically the camera was pointed straight down at the floorboard of the car, and you could kind of see like an orange glow to it, and you couldn't hear anything. And I was kind of going, okay, well, that doesn't seem right. I don't think they're repairing anything. So I rewound it like about 3 minutes, and the car's on track. And I'm like, okay, well, that thing's center mounted. That camera's center mounted. I think that car might have gotten a crash. And sure enough, yeah, they were looking at the replay, and yeah, that was a big, big off, and real glad that he's okay. He did go to the hospital for some checkups, but I don't believe he had any significant injuries. That was a huge hit. I mean, he basically went straight on into Eau Rouge, I believe, after getting a little loose and not being able to correct it as well. So, tough, tough hit. Which again brings out the full course yellow, brings out the safety car. We have a little bit of pit strategies that were into play with there, but it bunches the field up again. We have then at La Source, we have the number 666 Lambo that gets spun, almost causing an extra incident there, which then plays on later on. Not necessarily that it had anything to do with what happened later, but just shows that. That Lambo liked to make contact with cars, and a few hundred meters down that front stretch, there was more contact at the base of Eau Rouge with the Land Audi, and this was after coming to the green from that Stefano Telli, I believe, crash, and unfortunately, the 666 Lambo basically straight lined Eau Rouge, went up through the grass, essentially, you know, unsighted, hit the, or I believe either hit the barrier, the tire barrier, or hit just after the tire barrier, and basically spun around facing the other direction. So basically facing the hill, looking down at the top of Radion, looking down Eau Rouge, but basically over the hill. So you really couldn't see anything. And on the inside strip, almost where that the SMP LMP1 went vertical in May, and basically sat there for a good 10 to 15 seconds until another pack of cars came through. And unfortunately, the 31 Parker Racing Bentley, which is driven by, I believe, is Andy Merrick, pretty much went unsighted and just impacted the Lambo 666 head on. So it was a frontal impact for both of those cars. The Lambo basically having half of the front end just completely destroyed, and the Bentley, on some angles, looking like the actual structure of the car was completely damaged. I mean, I couldn't even see where the engine was in the front end of that Bentley, and even the roll cage looked like it was warped slightly. So there was a huge amount of concern. As soon as that crash had finished, there was a massive fire, and we really didn't see any video. We had really no information whatsoever. We had just had drivers that were very shaken when they had gotten out of the cars. They red flagged the event for about a couple hours to manage, clean up, repairs, that kind of thing. But the information was sparse. I mean, you really had no idea really who almost was involved outside of who didn't show up, you know, who didn't trigger the next timing loop. So that was a frustrating time as a fan to try to get information. However, just being in the, you know, information age, you're able to piece this stuff together. So again, it was probably one of the most scary accidents I've seen in a long time. That was, I mean, this just how the cars looked at the end of that wreck. That, I mean, I think it's so cliche to go like, oh, you know, we have to thank the safety standards that we have set up. But and in even the talks of like, oh, you know, 10 years ago, that guy wouldn't have survived. I'm pretty sure 10 years ago or 15 years ago, they would not have survived that. I mean, it just, that Bentley looked like it was not a racing car. I mean, it didn't even look like a car. It just looked like just a mangled amount of metal, and the back half of the car resembled a Bentley. So, very scary. Which kind of leads me to a little tangent point. It revolves mainly around the secrecy, especially with accidents. And I know that there is some specific discussion, hey, why is there not a camera at a specific angle and whatnot? And I get the monetary reasons and just the logistical reasons. I mean, they're getting smaller. Those reasons are getting less relevant as we get more technology keeps getting introduced. Just around the world, you know, in the world around us. I mean, we have streaming capabilities with cameras that are almost under $100 that are of almost 1080p quality, and even some management software of a lot of these surveillance systems that can be run on very, very old machines and still basically be able to give us even higher frame rates that you can see like almost with moving pictures. I mean, some of these surveillance cameras and stuff like that, we're still going almost like a couple frames a second. So you're seeing, you know, some delays and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, from the lack of evidence, that's fine. We should have a camera. I think there should be some static camera that's sitting there. There's enough accidents, and just even in the support races that were happening there, that I feel like we should have just had a static camera put there. The only other thing then would just be that you're protecting the brand. And I understand the SRO, I understand Blancpain, and that there is a lot of corporate entity and there's a lot of nurturing of the product, and that this series itself, you know, has sprung up as its own kind of marketable racing series that doesn't have the history outside of adopting this main 24-hour race, you know, in any huge format. I mean, we have the FIGT championship, that kind of stuff, but again, that has the history of the FIA and it has the previous past. So I see a lot of new age marketing and trying to curtail the product to, you know, to be palatable to sponsors, to drivers, to manufacturers, that kind of thing. And so to me, from a person that enjoys the racing, enjoys crashes, but enjoys understanding what's going on, it was extremely frustrating because you had no information at all from any of the officials. You really had no information from any of the announcers, and even most of the streams were just flippantly, you know, I guess they had, you know, they were filling time, but it was just, you know, everybody knew that there was a serious, serious accident. And I think everybody wanted to get the little bit of information of what was going on. And I think people just wanted to understand what happened. I mean, there's a serious accident. 9 times out of 10, you've got film of that. And I think there was even some people that were suggesting that people were telling them to take these down or to remove some of the pictures that were up. Or I think there might have been a video that somebody had that somebody had claimed that the SR had came to them and said not to upload that or whatever, told them not to. I don't know if that's true. I haven't had any evidence to say that there is anybody that has had to take anything down, but it certainly doesn't seem like that wouldn't be the case in some instances, just because I think that wreck was extremely nasty. And I think if we had pictures of the aftermath of what those two cars look like from, you know, extensive photos and all that stuff, there would be probably some questions. And that's my ultimate worry, is that if we are censoring nasty accidents, which, I mean, for the lack of a better term, we had two pretty massive accidents that we don't have on camera, on official camera, this year at Spa, in that exact spot, that is questionable to me. I don't think we should be so afraid to not even have specific angles of the track that we won't show if there might be an accident there. And I think censoring, you know, what people see, especially fans, and what the experience they get, doesn't help and improve the racing. It doesn't improve the sport. It doesn't make it so that, you know, that the sport is more palatable or palatable to, you know, to the masses. I think you are just limiting the information. And I think even in some of the replays and reviews, there's not a whole lot of talk of it. Some people didn't even know that there was a 2-hour, you know, almost a 2-hour red flag and race stoppage. They were trying to get the orders together and all this stuff. I mean, that's a big deal. And that's a 12th of the race that's basically ended because of a huge accident. And we didn't know if one of the guys was dead or not. I guess it is a complaint, or it's a little rant, or whatever. I don't think film and footage of accidents, especially serious ones, is a detriment to racing. And I think having more information is better than not. And the scary thing to me is that if we're selling these cars as being able to withstand impacts of 160 miles, 170 miles, however, 150 miles an hour, however fast that Bentley was going, as it was probably full gas, heading straight up in straight line that little off track to the left of the racing line at the top of Radeon, and it clearly isn't. Is that why we're hiding it? Are we rating these cars to be able to withstand, you know, these impacts, or are we just trying to hide that, hey, look, these cars will not save you in any scenario, and we'd rather not show you that because you would maybe get scared to race this than if you were to see the full thing? I mean, how much of the Rizzi crash, you know, with the Red Dragon in 2014 at Daytona 24, how much did that detract drivers from racing DPs? I didn't see a whole lot of drivers that were questioning whether or not they're going to jump back into a DP car, knowing full well that if the honest same racing scenario happened to them, they might be in the same issue. I just think if there was any video that was taken down, that's ridiculous. And if there was any, hey, let's not put a camera up here because we do not want to catch anything that might potentially go wrong, that's ridiculous. And I certainly am to the point where I think, well, we should just start getting cameras everywhere. I think there should be a level of understanding, even if there's a serious accident. Hey, look, this is racing. This is never going to be like soccer. This is never going to be like tennis. This is never going to be like any of these sports where 99.99999% of the time, if you're competing, you will never, ever have a serious injury in your life. This is motorsport, and you will probably be injured due to an event on track at some point in your career. Like, I just, the minimization of whatever this is for accidents, either for insurance purposes or whatever, I mean, it's starting to be glaring in some of these instances, and that was a huge wreck. I mean, a huge wreck. So, there's like a 10-minute rant, so I think I took up a third of this recap with that. But after that insane red flag, Bentley strategy was slightly confusing, and I do remember this specifically, where they could have done a brake change. I think it was literally at halfway point, and they didn't. They went out on pit exit to wait because they were still, I think, doing repairs during this red flag or something like that to one of theirs. Cut a tire, which then they had to come back in and then replace that, so they ended up losing some more time. So Bentley just having just a bunch of small little gaps, and again, while not keeping them out of it, never really keep putting them back into it, and really just kind of, still squandering really any advantage that they could have put themselves into team-wise. I know one of the cars was still a few laps down by this point anyway, so. And so as we go back to green, this is after halfway. By this time, the number 34 BMW of Walking Horse Motorsport BMW is leading overall. And somewhat of a surprise, I don't think we were all expecting. I mean, it was a pro attacking lineup that they had for the race, but I don't think anybody was really expecting them to shine through at this point of the race. And so that was refreshing kind of to see, because you just the WRT. With Porsche up there, Bentley's, Aston Martin's, just kind of the old kind of guard, and to see not row racing, but another BMW up there is I like that. I enjoy that. I think that's again what Spa gives you, is that there are 24 other competitors outside of the main ones that we kind of thought were going to go into it with an advantage. So gets again what the Spa 24 gives you. The 63, and I missed this earlier, was an early DNF, and that was something I didn't expect. They had qualified top 10, and I expected that Lambo to do well. They did have that contact early on and ended, and really couldn't do anything with it, retired. So some of the bigger names, obviously the Bentley's having issues, the 63 having issues there. And we get later into it as well, with the Porsche as well having issues. And again, with car contact and trying to overtake lap cars. So just a really, really tough outing. The morning comes with about 8 hours to go. So light finally hits, and we start finally getting rid of the madness of the blood moon. The 62, kind of from having the highs of the pole and leading in the first stages of the race, having rear end contact and really just dropping out from there, not really being able to do much, and really just suffering from just some bad luck at the end of the race or near the end of the race. But what was great to see too was that we still had just a huge amount of competition at the front of the field. I mean, even though we did have Walking Horse started to really stretch its legs in the night run, Row Racing 99, with Alexander Sims, was putting in some hero stints and really just clawed that car back up into contention. And it was really, it was almost a BMW battle with Marcus Winklehawk kind of leading the charge for Audi as well in the 25, really trying as hard as he could to make up some time and really to be the best of the rest, because it at the end ended up really being a big show between the 34 and the 99, and what a race that ended up being when it came down to it. The different calls for strategy for both of those and how they worked in full course yellows and safety cars really taxed team strategy at almost equally as much as the track taxed the car and the driver. And that was a great kind of endurance. It was just really refreshing to see that kind of where the entire team had to play their A game in order to beat the competition. We saw incidents as well as nighttime to daytime. Look, it's not going to make a difference. We are 18, 19, 20 hours into this, so teams are tired, cars are tired. The Nissan is ablaze in the pits, unfortunately. Nissan's one of those other ones too that I would love to see them do something well with that at some point. I know that the level of commitment they have sometimes for this race isn't as high as others, but that's another car that I love seeing when it performs well. But man, they've had some pretty unbelievable bad luck fall upon that car, the last few years of 22 and 23. So fire for them, and I believe they did. I don't know if they outright retired after that. They might have retired after that. I might need to confirm that. And then again, bad luck too for another British bad luck. Aston Martin having issues, and now the 118 McLaren with Chris Harris, who had done some early on leading in the early stages of the event in the Pro-Am category, gets hit in the rear and loses a rear wing. So McLaren trying out a wingless bodywork for a bit. The number 34 regaining the lead after pits, and again showing some full race dominance, not dominance, but some competitiveness, and that again was something that I expected the 34 to start falling off at some point. The driver lineup is great, and I don't fault any of that whatsoever. I just think that, just not necessarily inexperience, but just almost inexperience at the point. And usually in these races, there's some issue, there's some mistake that kind of comes and bites you, but it just never kept hitting the 34, and they just kept staying with Rowe, staying with Black Falcon in the number 4 as well, Mercedes, who was up there. But really, those two BMWs were the ones that could really pull the gap from the field when the greens came back out, and you saw them really having a race of their own at the end. One of the bigger end of the race incidents involved the 8 and the number 117, so the Bentley and the Porsche. Both of them were fighting pretty tough between each other and were trying to overtake an Audi, which unfortunately got loose out of No Name, or whatever they named it now, and basically bottled both of them up, actually launching the Bentley up in the air a bit, causing immense damage to the 117, ultimately retiring it. The number 8 basically taking 10 minutes of repair time, only to be sent out and basically conk out on its outlap. So both of those front-running cars, I believe in the top 10 at the time, were eliminated from the race, basically due to a backmarker incident. So traffic always comes into play with this track, and even though there are places that have miles and miles of runoff, a lot of times that doesn't help you. And the track is still narrow where you're supposed to stay in between the white lines. And so, unfortunately, the Porsche and Bentley having issues there, basically really taking out two still contenders at that point. The number 7, number 8 I think was down a couple. Well, I think they were sort of fighting position. I don't know if they were on the lead lap or not. But the number 7 definitely kills the hopes of Bentley with issues pretty much at the end of the race. Like I said before, the Bentley just always, I think their action sheet of the entire race is just always like 3 pages long, and it's usually like incidents or problems, and it's never just like clean pit stop, clean driver change, clean pit stop, like clean brake change. it's going to happen eventually, but maybe they need more cars. The 29 gets a time penalty as well, so that does affect their top 10 runner due to, I think, a corner cut at a bus stop. So, again, track limits are always a thing. I would talk your ear off again about that, Flood, but I don't think I want to do this time. And then lastly, it really did come down to strategic full course yellow and some safety car procedures and just when to box, when to come in to take that last bit of fuel. And when to really execute really your best pit stop yet. And between Rowe and Walkenhorst, it ended up being the 34 favor. And Tom Blomqvist pretty much handing off to Philip Eng and him riding out to the end and finishing overall in first, winning the 70th total 24 hours of Spa. So a first-time win for Walkenhorst overall at the Spa 24, and their team basically with tears in their eyes pretty much as after winning it. Rowe coming a pretty close second, 11 seconds back, and with the 29 Van der Linde coming in third with a time penalty, though. So I believe they did drop back down to fourth after that, after looking at the final standings here. So, but beyond that, BMW really shining through with their M60 T3. And this really coming, not necessarily as a surprise, but, well, definitely with the overall winner as a surprise, but the overall platform, I definitely thought the Audis and the Mercedes were fast. Again, I think the Bentleys potentially may have had the fastest overall car. I don't know how it would have really been in the lead during the day with the final hours, but for a lot of the race, those cars had the ability to just climb through the field at will, along with the BMW. So, and a very, very well-earned win for the 34, with having four cars still in the lead lap after 24 hours and a host of full course yellow, red flag, and safety car conditions. So there was minefields all over this race, and a first-time winner comes out on top. That's all I've got for you, Flood. Hopefully you guys were listening a little bit. I didn't rant too hard, but what a fantastic, fantastic race. This race, while it might not be the most unregulated race, the 24-hour race that you're going to see throughout the year, it by and far and away is the most competitive. And if you have not seen it, there are streams already up. There are the last 15 laps, I think, and some race reviews. So take a look at those, and we'll join you next year for the 71st running of the 24 Hours of Spa at Spa-Francorchamps. Back to you.
Thank you very much for those thoughts and insights, Cookie Monster. And just to quickly wrap up on that, not only is the last 15 laps up on YouTube, but now actually the whole race is up on YouTube. So if you missed it, you can go back and watch the whole thing. Moving on now to the ELMS at the Red Bull Ring, and joining me for the rest of the episode, I have Trevor Vasaurus. How are you going?
Not too bad, not too bad.
ELMS, right? ELMS at the Red Bull Ring. This was towards the end of July. I think it was the 22nd of July, so a little bit ago now. But firstly, how good was it to see prototype racing again, seeing as we hadn't had any since the 24 Hours of Le Mans? And on top of that, how good was it to see something like 35 prototypes go into the first corner of the Red Bull Ring? Just what a beautiful sight.
It was absolutely brilliant. Yeah, really nice, refreshing back into the swing of things. Lots of prototypes through LMP2 and LMP3. Yeah, really good to kick back into gear.
Yeah, and what a beautiful backdrop as well. I mean, the Red Bull Ring, when I was a lot younger, I'll get my words out eventually, I didn't actually really appreciate how good it was as a setting, but now you just watch the cars fly through the mountains, you're like, what a beautiful place for a racetrack. Whoever thought of that idea should get a cookie.
And the commentators, they were hardly ever saying anything other than what was going on track, because it was a pretty entertaining race, but yeah, pretty much the only thing they were ever talking about was how beautiful the area, the track was in.
It is just
worth going for a visit.
I it's on my bucket list, man. I've got only a few racetracks on my bucket list, and that one's definitely one of them. But we should talk about the racing. So we had on the front row of the grid, I think it was a bit of a surprise. I'm just going to quickly double check before I make a fool of myself. It was,
I believe it was the Edex Sport,
Orica. Of Paul Lafarge, who was one of the surprise packet cars from the Le Mans race. One of the top placed, well, it was looking like it was going to be one of the top placed cars late in the race until it, I think, ran into a problem or crashed out. But they ended up taking pole position by 0.02 of a second over the Duquesne engineering car, which was another little bit of a surprise packet, with Pierre Ragged behind the wheel. So it was pretty interesting from that aspect, because even further, like the heavyweights of the class, you know, your United Autosports, your G Drives, your TDS Racings, they were, you know, three or four rows back down the grid. So it did make, and of course we had Heinrich Hedman in fourth, so that made for a, let's say, awkward start for the first few laps of the race.
Well, to be fair, he did well. He didn't have major contact at the start of the race, but we might come on to that. later.
Didn't he get a penalty, though, for tagging an LMP, a GTE car, sorry? I feel like
I wouldn't be surprised, but I'd best be nice to him.
Well, the thing that sort of characterized the first part of the stint, though, was people lower in the grid trying to process him. But I've got to say, he looks much more comfortable in an LMP2 car than he does an LMP1 car. Would you agree?
Yeah, I do agree.
Yeah.
But also, he has fewer cars coming up behind him. He did lose out a lot of spots at the start, so I'm sort of contradicting my point with cars coming up behind and overtaking him. If he was, for example, imagine in an LMP2 car at Le Mans, or an LMP1 car, rather, with hybrids coming up behind him, I'd be, yeah, pretty scared the way they accelerate.
Just a lot. Just a lot, really, I feel. I gotta say, ELMS this season has been one of the better series, and it's because we have so many of these tightly packed teams at the very top. And that was sort of another thing that characterized the first part of the race, was that you had things like G-Drive up the front, Duquesne up the front, IDEX Sport, I think Graf even made a charge towards the front early on the race, and somehow they managed to get through the first lap without hitting anyone, which is phenomenal, because like the first two corners on the Red Bull Ring are like two of the tightest corners that you would ever see. But yeah, all in all, it was a very, very good race in terms of a racing perspective, but there was always this constant threat of weather around the track. And once the weather started to play a little bit of havoc with the cars and with the conditions, it was just like, okay, well, everything that we've done is just going to get thrown out the window now.
Well, yeah, it was interesting in how they played that weather in terms of when the pro drivers were implemented in the car. And in a post-race interview, Jean-Éric Vergne was saying that was, you know, one of the times when he was in the car really pushing and making a difference was in the changing track conditions. It did rain, but it wasn't enough for a change of tyres. And by the teams having the best drivers in these conditions in the car at that time, you could really make the difference.
And I think that was one of the things that really G-Drive especially were able to capitalize on, the fact that they had Jean-Éric Vergne in the car at that point in time, whereas I think other people like United Autosports had Phil Hansen and IDEX Sport had Paul Lafarge, so not really their best drivers, more so like their amateur drivers or something like that. So it just meant that they weren't able to push on in those conditions. But one thing that I did really sort of... not really enjoy is G-Drive. I'm kind of over them just winning everything.
Especially considering they had a drive-through penalty for jumping the start.
Yeah, and I can understand why they've done what they've done, because so the issue that I have, of course, with this car is the fact that their silver driver is basically a Formula 2 driver. And it's not something that other teams haven't done in the past, especially in the WEC, but it's just like, man, just stop. Just stop. You're ruining the competition for everyone.
Well, they have a risky, unsustainable sort of system, the way they do it, in that they find that silver driver that really shouldn't be a silver driver. At Le Mans, Pizzitola was doing some of the best times, much better than the pro drivers.
Pizzitola, just quickly on that note, he had a top... Sorry to jump in over the top of you, but just to exemplify that point, he had a top 20 lap average time. So you know, the top 20 laps that he did, his average time for those top 20 laps was the third best of the entire LMP2 field, every single other driver. This is including, like, your Nicolai Lapierre's, your freaking Renge van der Zander's, your Pierre Thiriers, your Vincent Capilliers, just everyone from the absolute amateurs to the best drivers in the class, like your Will Stevens as well. He had the third best top 20 lap average out of everyone. As a silver driver.
That's unsustainable.
As a silver driver.
That's unsustainable.
Yeah.
Because it's only going to last for a season, and then he's going to be recategorized and is going to get shipped off to somewhere else.
But, I mean, yes, you're correct, but can't they just bring in the next F2 driver who's 17 years old and already basically a pro?
And that's the frustrating thing. And then that's the risky thing that the team plays, because they can't build on consistent performances. They've got to bring in someone new. The same happened with Rusinov, but he's still in the same team, so it's a bad example.
And,
but...
well, he's also the money behind the car. And I feel like he wants to be silver. He tries to be silver. He's too good to be silver, though, is the problem.
Yeah, I agree.
So that kind of muted the battle at the front, especially after you said the fact that they got a drive-through penalty right at the beginning of the race, and then were just able to just win by 20-odd seconds. It's just kind of like, well, okay then, I guess. There's not to discount the work of the crew and the work of the team and the work of the drivers. It's just a bit annoying, especially when you've got people like, Paul Petit and Pierre Rags and, actual amateurs in this class as well, trying to be competitive.
And on the other hand, this was a good example of strategy winning races and strategists thinking on their feet. The 26G drive, they reacted and were quite lucky with some safety car running at the end of the race, and that sort of helped them out a lot in the reshuffling. And then once they were so far ahead, they just had to not screw it up,
which was good that they got Rusinov's driving time out of the way by that point, isn't it? I'm still not over what happened at Le Mans last year. I don't think I'll ever be over. Anyway, it's a good point you make about the strategy, though, because we did see quite a frequent instance of interruptions throughout, especially the middle part of the race, with things like full-course yellows and safety cars. I feel like one of the LMP3 cars caught fire at one point as well, with Sean Rahal behind the wheel. So it wasn't as if they were... it wasn't as if it was a straightforward race. As you mentioned, the teams that were able to change their strategy and capitalize on these sort of things were a bit further up come the end of the race. But I do want to make mention of one particular team who I thought exceeded expectations, which was the Decayne Engineering team, who ended up finishing second overall in a very tight battle in the end, actually, with the race engineering team, who won the first race of the season. But then I found out after the race that they had failed a post-race inspection due to a fuel irregularity. So that made me really sad, because Decayne Engineering really deserved, especially after the weekend they had, like qualifying in second to the grid as well, they really deserved to take home a second place.
Yeah, it was this all over again. Finishing the race, and then getting dragged through another fuel problem, refueling problem. And like, just like you had to live through after Le Mans.
Yeah, and like, you've been on the podium enjoying all that and everything, and they would have been, second or third in the championship on the back of that result? I'm just trying to work out a little bit of math. Yeah, they would have been just outside third in the championship. But instead, they're down now in fifth, very, very far away from the lead. So it was just a bit of a pain, especially the fact that it came out like the day after and they'd done such a good job over the entire weekend. It was just really, really sad. But what actually was the problem?
So at the end of each race, the cars have a sample of fuel taken, and this was analysed by the scrutineers, and it was found that 0.5% of the fuel in the sample was of the wrong fuel supplied. So Total, I believe, sponsors the race, and all the cars have to run this same fuel. And it was found out that some of the fuel, the 0.5%, was illegal fuel. It was the same octane rating, so you'd expect to have a pretty similar performance. There might be different additives in the fuel, but it was an ELF fuel, and this is due to the fuel used in a test, I think a week beforehand, in the car. And this fuel then was not removed adequately, and I believe it was recycled into the total fuel for the race, then contaminating it.
Which is a real shame, because it just seems like a pretty thoughtless error on the team's behalf to have that sort of mix-up. But I would have thought that, yeah, you would expect if they just kept the fuel in the tank that they would have burnt through it in the first stint, and then you wouldn't have any of that fuel left. But yeah, you suggested that they actually recycled it back into the fuel for the entire weekend. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that was my first thought, because 0.5% you think is a small amount, but it's actually quite significant if you think about how many times there's been a fuel cycle of emptying and refilling the tank. So before the race, but during practice, you want to have you want to measure the amount of fuel used in a stint or in a long run, so then you can predict how many laps you can do on a tank of fuel during the race on race pace. And so there's already some refueling cycles there. But even in the race, you go from full fuel down to not that much, then refuel down to not that much. And so you're cutting down on the percentage of the wrong fuel by a significant amount in each fuel cycle. And they did, I think, 5 refueling stops in the race.
I think it's 4. So, I think they can do 5 stints.
Ah, okay. That's it then.
Yep. But still, yeah, you're absolutely right. If you're refueling the car 4 times throughout a race, even if you start with almost entirely the wrong fuel, you should be able to burn, yeah, by the time you get to the end, it should be so dilute that you probably shouldn't even be detecting it. So the fact that it was 0.5 is quite a high number. And, yeah, they said, the team said that they used leftover fuel from Le Mans because they were in the Road to Le Mans race, the sister car, the LMP3 car. So that fuel was the ELF fuel. And then they had a test day, which was free fuel, and that was on the Wednesday immediately before the event. And so they just used leftover fuel from Le Mans, and then, yeah, they probably, yeah, as you said, cycled it into the rest of their fuel reserves. Yeah, which is a real shame, and hopefully it's an error that they won't ever make again. Like, it's one of those things that you make it once and then you never do it again, fingers crossed.
And that's across the whole grid as well, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah, the team principal was like straight away put his hand up, was like, yep, we screwed up. We're really, really, really sorry to everyone who gave us such a good result. Please don't hate us.
And that's the appropriate way to take it. And that's and it was also the appropriate way to send out the penalty from the organizers. It was very quick, it was very clear. And I think it was done appropriately.
Yeah. And some people might be saying, oh, it's a disqualification. That's super duper harsh. But the reality is, if you fail the technical regulations, you are going to get disqualified. Like, it's as simple as that. If you don't meet the TEG regs, you're exempt. That's it.
Correct.
That's, yeah. So with their disqualification, that meant that the race engineering car got promoted to second. And the United Autosports car, the number 22 Paul Hansen, Philippe Albuquerque car, got promoted to third, which I feel like is their best result of the season thus far. Whereabouts is my results? Yes, it is. After having a shocking race at Monza and an even worse race at Paul Ricard. So good signs for United Autosports for a change, which is nice.
And good signs for Ligier as well, because it's probably the best finish this season that any non-Orica has ever had.
I just want to check that, because I don't feel like that's entirely correct, but it is definitely entirely plausible. No, yeah, you're right. Entirely correct, in fact. I do actually want to make mention, it felt like, I didn't actually note any of this down or anything, but it felt like there was a lot more parity between the three classes on this track, even with the Dallara, which is meant to be more of a sort of car you'd expect to be better at higher speeds. It did just seem that, you know, there was like the Villorba Corsa car and the Ligier cars and the, like even the AVF car, which is one of the newer Dallara cars, they all just seem to have pace at different parts of the race and be competitive in different parts of the race. Did you notice the same as well?
Yeah, I was impressed. Yes, they weren't really pushing at the head of the field, but yeah, I was impressed by the Dallara's really, you know, pushing against some of the other competition in different chassis.
Yeah. It was just a shame that they all had really bad results and ran into problems. the highest place Dallara was the SMP racing car back in seventh. So, and that was a lap down as well.
Unfortunately for them, yes.
Makes me sad. I do love the look of the Dallara, and I hope that these signs of parity aren't just like smoke and mirrors. I hope that this is actually what is actually happening across the field, because I do want to see more shapes and sizes around the LMP2 field, especially in the WEC. Does sort of feel like it's Formula Orica still. But these are definitely encouraging signs, I feel.
And also what's encouraging with parity is the Michelin tyres. The teams are really starting to get used to them. Duquesne Engineering were using them and set some pretty good times. Even on the third lap was the best lap they set. So, you know, pretty high fuel load to set the fastest lap of the race before they met the traffic. But yeah, the Dunlop did get first and second.
And third.
Well, and third after the disqualification. But it was good on pace for the Michelin on the Duquesne Engineering car.
Yeah, good pickup. It does seem like as the LMP2 formula gets more and more into things, that they're finding more and more ways to make it a little more equal. And that, I feel like, is a very good thing, because it means that you don't have a monopoly of chassis. So this is something that I've been talking about since probably the beginning of the new regulations. We're just going to go off on a complete tangent here. We didn't plan this. But one of the reasons I feel like the Orica is quote-unquote the strong chassis is not necessarily entirely to do with the chassis, but also to do a bit with the teams that run it. It just seemed that that little bit of an advantage that the Orica had at the beginning of the regulation cycle has meant that it's gravitated the teams that would be at the top of the series towards that chassis anyway. So you don't necessarily see strong teams running the Ligiers or the Dallaras, except maybe United Autosports, and you could argue that SMP Racing's LMP2 is a strong team, I guess. But outside of those two, you don't really have like a G-Drive or a Alpine running anything other than an Orica, do you?
That's another good point, yeah.
So yeah, that's my thought. So hopefully as we see more parity between the classes, we'll see more variety amongst the top tier teams. And so it will be less like Formula Orica. I feel like that's everything about the LMP2 class. LMP3 was a race that was pretty well controlled by the RLR M Sport team. And I think it was the... who was the other team that was up the front for most of the race but faded towards the
Euro
end?
Euro International. They were leading for a short period of the race near the end, around the safety car. I think they lucked out with the safety car, but then they had an electrical problem which took them down to fifth, I think, which then lost them the lead of the championship to RLR.
And on top of that as well, they actually were awarded a drive-through penalty for some reason. I'm just going to have a quick look at that now. That was converted after the race had finished. So they didn't just drop down to fifth. They actually dropped even further down to seventh. And it was for causing a collision with the 83 car, which I feel like is the Crone Racing car. So that must have been quite late in the race because I don't remember seeing that at all.
That's interesting.
Mm. So, yeah, even more pain for them. So, yeah, not exactly the best race for Euro International. Yeah, losing the championship lead, as you mentioned. But that championship in the LMP3 class, sorry, is actually really, really tight amongst the top five, top four rather. So the gap at the front is only 4.5 points, which is less than a race win, much less than a race win, in fact, between RLR and Euro International. And then further down, you have Inter Europol, which is a further 9 points behind. Which they grabbed their first podium, which is pretty impressive. And then 360 Racing in fourth, only 1 point behind the Inter-Europol competition. Surprisingly, though, for me, is the absence of United Autosports in those four cars. What happened? Well, we already discussed how they started on, caught on fire, but that was the sister car, in fact. So, yeah, what happened with the number three car?
Was that the one that that pretty much destroyed its engine with
could
overheating?
I'm not sure.
There was one that I think it was Falb driving.
Yeah, that was the one that caught on fire halfway through the race. That car is actually even worse off than the sister car at the moment. That car is in eighth place in the championship, but the sister car, the number three car, they finished quite a well away off the pace in, I think, 12th position. So not a good race for one of the teams you'd expect to be a championship contender.
And then, I think it depends on the current youth or amateur drivers they happen to have in the car. That might be the car that's has a less chance of pushing up the front. For example, IDEX Sport, they've got in LMP2 a real front runner in the Orica, and then the Ligier car is pretty much always at the back.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. It was just interesting seeing as that number three car has come off a third place at Monza, so it was a little bit of a surprise. Yeah, that championship is a really tight championship. It is, I will admit, it is a little hard to keep track of because a lot of the broadcast time in the ELMS race gets focused on the top of the LMP2 field because the LMP2 field is just huge. So the LMP3 can kind of get lost in the noise. But there is a lot of competition in the LMP3 class, and it is definitely worth checking out if you can manage it. If you're not trying to watch it at double speed to catch up. Oh, my life. To round off the Red Bull round, LMGTE was six car entry field, and finally we have a race win for Porsche in the ELMS with this new car. Finally!
How convincing was that? It was almost flag to flag.
It was pretty nice.
It was one corner pretty much from flag to flag.
It's good to be home. It's good to be home. Yeah, the Proton competition car, the number 88, Rota and Cairoli car took home a extremely convincing win by a lap and then some. It ended up being like a lap and three quarters, which made me very, very happy. But it did mean that it is just a little sad for me that the GTE class in the LMS is so thin. Like with the movement away of Aston Martin from the class, and you know the fact that it hasn't ever really been a super strong class anyway, it just kind of, when you compare it to the LMP3 class, there's just a huge discrepancy in numbers.
But also, who are they competing against? They're competing against GT3 Racing, which has got so many different teams around the world who are doing a pro-am setup, whereas yeah. LMP3 is one of the fewer places where you can get a pro-am prototype
and be competitive. Yeah.
And yes, can be competitive.
Yeah, it's just a bit, That's a very good point. And you wouldn't run a GTE program if you weren't planning on taking it to Le Mans. And I think there was maybe one car in the current ELMS field that wasn't at Le Mans this year. I think that's the Krone Racing car. I think everyone else, at least one or two of the drivers, were at Le Mans in some way, shape, or form. So, yeah, that's a good point and not something I'd considered. But I wish there was more places for these GTE cars to run then outside of WEC, because I want to see more of this Pro-Am GTE stuff. I wonder if it's worth introducing a GT3 class to ELMS.
Just like a Michelin Le Mans Cup kind of style.
Yeah, just to sort of bolster the GT numbers. Because, like, yeah, you can spend all days lapping prototypes and it looks awesome because you've got, like, 30-odd prototypes. But it just, for me, it doesn't really feel the same as a multi-class race with GT cars. Also the fact that the GT cars are one lap off the LMP3 place is just kind of a bit, yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. Think about how many, also, if you're a team owner for a GTM team, what options have you got? BMW, not available yet. Ford, not available. So what have you got? Aston are not here anymore. You've just got the Porsche and the Ferrari to choose from.
Yeah. Or the Corvette, if, you know, they were ever willing to build another one and sell it to someone other than Labra.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, let's just tie a nice little bow on that and leave that for another time. So yeah, A8 car took the win ahead of the 55 Spirit of Race car, which was a lap and then some down. And then almost two laps down was the, over two laps down was the EBI Motors car, the kind of navy blue Porsche, and then the other Proton car, and then Krone Racing bring up the rear with JMW unfortunately not being classified. So what that means in terms of the championship is that the Proton car actually rockets to the top of the championship now, with the EBI Motors car surprisingly in second place, and that is off the back of three consecutive third places. So they're doing much better than I thought they were. But I would still expect JMW Motorsport especially to be bringing the competition more towards the last half of the season. Any final comments on the Red Bull round, Red Bull racing? That one of the ELMS before we move on.
Big points lost from JMW.
Yeah, real big points. They dropped from, I think, leading the championship to being in fifth. So, huge loss.
Big swing.
But I would still expect them to come back, especially seeing as the next round is their home track. So the next round for the ELMS is at Silverstone, which is also a part of the WEC weekend. So we have a WEC ELMS doubleheader, which I think is one of my favorite phrases in motorsport, because it just means you get 10 hours of top level prototype endurance racing in one weekend. Oh, doesn't that just sound so good?
It's going to be great.
Going to be great. Are you going?
I may be going. We shall have to wait and see.
You should definitely go and then tell us about it.
I wouldn't be able to think.
Why?
It would be great. All those Porsches.
Oh,
my brain would be scrambled.
That actually does sound like the best time. Anyway, before I get too jealous and decide to just cut this short straight away out of rage and anger, there are a few changes up and down the ELMS driving grid for the ELMS race. So what changes have been made
across the grid? For ELMS, the number 17 IDEXport Ligier and the 33 TDS Racing Orica are absent. They compared to the Red Bull Ring race. And also there's an addition for the Silverstone round, which is the Gulf Racing 911 RSR. They're going to be doing both the WEC race and the ELMS race. with the same driver lineup. So they're doing back-to-back races across the weekend, that is. And that'll be their first race back in ELMS since the opener at Paul Ricard.
So it's interesting. It's interesting that Golf are coming back to do both. Do you think that's what do you think that is?
Well, it's they're already going to be in the area, and they've entered in the past, like I said, at Paul Ricard. So it's good, good experience. Yeah, racing for the enjoyment of racing.
Yeah, but that means we get double Wainwright in a weekend. I'm not sure that I'm okay with that. But we also get double Alex Davison, which is a driver from Australia. So that's a good thing. I'll take that. But you mentioned the TDS cars as not going to be there as well. So that's the Francois Perrodeau, Loic Duval, Matteo Vaxivière car. Why can't they do the same? Like, is there any particular reason?
It could be if it's the same chassis. I'm not sure if it is or not, but it could be preserving mileage and also going all in on the WEC race rather than using up, you know, your resources and energy on ELMS.
Interesting call.
So the there have been some tweaks to the driver lineups as well.
Okay.
So the Mathieu Vaxivière has replaced, or will replace rather, Olivier Pla in the 24 Racing Engineering Orica, the red and yellow machine. And this is because Matt Vax is doing both this and WEC in the TDS Orica.
Yep, and Pla, I remember reading something recently that Pla said he was going to focus on the WEC effort. That's with Ford, right?
Yes, I believe that's the case.
Yep. Cool, I'm just opening up that article now just to double check. And yes, that is entirely correct, which is a change for us because normally we're kind of mostly correct. So we should see, I think it's a few less prototypes, an extra GT car. So that's pretty good. And they've got, of course, a four-hour race on the Saturday, which is as the curtain raiser to the WEC race, of course, on the Sunday. Now, before we start talking about WEC in earnest, I just wanted to make a mention of the fact that this is the Silverstone 6 hour returning to its formerly regular time slot of mid to late August. This was before the WEC was like actually the WEC and was just still remaining as the Intercontinental Le Mans Cup, I think, where it used to be in August. But I wonder how much that will affect the conditions around the track and during the race. Because we have seen in the past, I think 2014 comes to mind, where we had torrential downpour on race day, which threw everything out of the window. So being a semi-local, I don't know how local you are to the track, but you're in England, so it's pretty much the same from an Australian point of view. I'm sorry if that's offensive. I'm not actually,
right,
sorry.
A little ditty country.
So how much of an effect do you think will transitioning from sort of early to mid-spring to now the tail end of summer be in terms of the track temps and that sort of stuff?
So we've sort of at the end now of a so-called heat wave.
What, was it 25 degrees for 3 days in a row?
Oh, so hot. So at the end of this sort of load of hot weather, it's tailing off now, and the weather forecast, which is probably going to be wrong, is cloudy, overcast, a little bit of sun, and just over 20 degrees.
Perfect for swing bowling if you're a cricket fan. Of course, if you're a cricket fan, you're probably angry that it's been raining at Lords for the past week, but also you'd probably be enjoying the English results. I'm going to stop talking about that now because that makes me mad. So shouldn't be too affected by the weather then in terms of rain, right? Because the last one we won is another rained out race.
Low chance of rain, and much lower chance of snow compared to the April time slot.
That's still one of the most surreal things I've ever seen in motorsports. Snow during practice. That's just ridiculous. So it should be a great weekend of racing. If you're in the area, you should definitely head down to the track. Let's talk now about some of the going-ons in the WEC since Le Mans, because there has been quite a bit in the almost 2 months of quote-unquote off-season, which it kind of felt like as far as WEC went. So the first things first, still coming on from Le Mans, there is still the refueling drama saga, really, through G-Drive and TDS. So the point where they've lodged a full-on appeal now to, like, the Court of Arbitration for Sport, I think, and they're not going to find out the result of the LMP2 class at Le Mans until September, which is like, oh, guys, just, you cheated. Just let it go already. You cheated. Just stop.
I think they're just trying to
prolong the most misery. Of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is the worst. But more so from that, there are a few changes, mostly in the LMP1 class for the upcoming race at Silverstone. So I think we'll go through in sort of chronological order in terms of how they were revealed. So the first one is the fact that we have a new EOT for the LMP1 class at Silverstone. So just as a quick overview of the EOT. We're taking the following decisions. The performance gap of 0.25% is being reduced to 0% between the hybrid and non-hybrid cars. The fuel flow for the privateer LMP1s go from 108 to 115 kilograms per hour, which is now 35 kilograms per hour more than the hybrids. And the refueling system has also been increased for the private teams. And they're going to get a weight reduction. So what does this say to you, Trevorosaurus? Because it certainly says something to me.
Well, it says that they acknowledge that there's a problem. But we'll see if that does actually fix the problem. Also, piques my interest in that that we hear there is they say that they'll improve or reduce the disparity between refueling, but they don't say that they will equalize it exactly, which is open to still there being a bit of a difference in the pits.
And they're not exactly comprehensive with how they're increasing it. There isn't actually any numbers. Everything else, there's numbers that you can point to and go, look, there's actually a thing, but it just says increased.
Well, so that would be the restrictor put in place in the fuel rig system. Maybe they haven't quantified that restrictor change in terms of diameter, or quantified it in terms of time to refill a certain volume. Or have a flow rate value change. But yes, I think that's allowing them to still have a certain card to play in Toyota's corner.
Just quickly, just want to clarify that it's just the naturally aspirated engines that are going to naturally aspirated engined cars that are going to be receiving the weight reduction. So who does that leave in the field who will be benefiting from that? Is the AER turbocharged?
Correct. AER is turbocharged. So the Gibson
The BR1, cars. Yep. So the two Rebellions and the Dragon Speed car. And we're not mentioning the Mana car because the Mana car has actually pulled out of the WEC weekend at Silverstone because they are changing their engine from the underperforming Mechachrome to the AER engine that is currently in the BR Engineering cars. So that is... That is a, like, as far as surprises and shocks in terms of this season, that is one that caught me a little off balance, I will say. Because you would expect out of all the races that Mana would want to compete in other than the Mon, they would want to be racing at their home track.
That was my thought as well. Running on a skeleton budget, I was predicting a few weeks ago or a month ago that if they were doing a reduced number of races, that Silverstone would be one of them, if not the only one in between Le Mans rounds, because there's a lot less to do in terms of logistics.
Exactly, yeah. So the fact that they're pulling out means that there is something going very awry in the Mana camp currently. So the reason that they've actually pulled out isn't to do with the engine or funding. It's that they did it too late to change their entry on the WEC. So, of course, the WEC only allows entries for certain races ahead of a specific time. If you need to change your entry after that date, you kind of have to remove it. And so that's what's happened. They've just made the decision to change from the Mechachrome engine to the AER engine after that cutoff date. And as a result, they've had to pull out of the race. But I think it is very interesting that some of the comments and some of the sort of replies that have come up from both Mechachrome and Ginetta in the fallout of this decision. So I'm just going to summarize bits and pieces of the Mechachrome statement because I feel like there's some pertinent bits of information here. So Mechachrome requested a financial commitment as an insurance from Ginetta prior to the signature of contracts. With that deposit being funded into engine development. Apparently, this contract with the Mana team was not fully ratified before Spa. Mechachrome were extremely concerned with financial risks, and basically what they're saying is due to the fact that the team has no funding and the car has no funding, it means that they've had no funding to really work on the engine. And on top of that, all of the issues that the car has had has reduced its running time, which also means they haven't been able to gain any data to develop the engine. So yeah, it's not really, very happy from the Mechachrome side, but they have kind of gone on and said, we're still committed to making an LMP1 engine, and we look forward to returning to endurance racing. On the flip side, Ginetta have basically said it wasn't our call, it was entirely to do with Mana, and we're not going to affix blame to either the team or the engine or anything in terms of why this decision has been made. However, performance specifications provided by Mechachrome were not met throughout the program. So, yeah, a little bit of trouble in paradise.
I believe that Mana understood that they would have an initial engine and then develop that engine based on data gathered. But what Mana, I believe, have been saying is that they've been not impressed enough even by the base version to then build upon.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. Yeah, just part of the Ginetta statement, performance specifications were provided by Mechachrome as part of the contract between Ginetta and Mechachrome. Part of the issue is that the engines as supplied did not even meet the conservative parameters that were agreed. So basically what they're saying is the engine was crap from the very beginning, which is not how you want to start a LMP1 engine program. However, it does... I feel a little sorry for Mechachrome because this is their first year as a bespoke engine supplier for LMP1. And you look at the cars around them, you've got the Gibson engine, which has been run by Rebellion for the past few years and also in LMP2. And then you've got the AER engine, which has been a very strong engine in LMP1 for a while now. So it's not like the AER engine has ever been underdeveloped or even though it's the first time it's been in LMP1 for a while, it's still I'm pretty sure that engine also races in another series. I just can't quite place where. Is
the Mechachrome or the AER?
No, the AER.
Good question.
I might just be talking out of my butt. But either way, and then the other engine they've got in this class is of course the Nismo engine from the old the GTRLM Nismo, which has been said by a few drivers, Marco Bononomi, most notably, to be the best LMP1 engine that he's ever driven. So, yeah, it's the fact that this Mechachrome engine is so far behind is, you know, bad for them, but like it is their first year, which makes it a little crap in terms of just in general.
It shot nice flames out the back, though, which is nice.
Is it meant to?
On the overrun, I mean, oh, God. Going into Arnage, like at Le Mans, under braking, the flames out the back of it. What?
That's also
sad to see them go.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Hopefully we see them back at some point. And also, hopefully we see Manor Ginetta back at some point, because this has just been the latest in a continuing trend of circling the drain for the Manor program. That's kind of been going on since the very beginning of the program, the first reveal. I think one of our correspondents, we have correspondents, what? Alex Sinclair has even said that when he saw it at the motor show, wherever it was first revealed, that the fit and finish just wasn't great, and it kind of was not what he was expecting in terms of a car that was being presented for the first time to an audience. So the fact that, you know, they've had money problems at Spa, they've had reliability problems everywhere they've gone, they only got one car to the end of Le Mans, many, 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 many laps down, and now they're having trouble with their engine supplier as well. It's just, I don't have a lot of hope for this program anymore.
It's difficult to keep positive. It is really difficult to keep positive when so much of the news is negative. But, you know, the mechanics are still working hard. They've got this new AER engine fitted in the car. It's running in the car. They're doing all the necessary modifications. For example, going from, I think, the single turbo to the twin turbo design. They've got to make sure that the cooling is appropriate because turbos are mounted really outboard in the side pods of the vehicle. The exhaust isn't top mounted by the shark fin anymore. It's down in front of the rear wheels. All of this has to be made sure to be working correctly. Yeah.
So they basically
don't overheat.
They've basically got to redesign a bunch of the car.
Yeah.
Which is going to put extra strain on an already skeleton budget.
Correct. It's a shame, but they can do it. But it's going to be, you know, super skeleton budget.
Powered by Yorkshire tea.
Oh, proper brew.
So, look, personally, this may be a bit of a doom and gloom scenario, but I do not be... I would not be surprised if they see maybe the Fuji round of the season and then nothing else until next season.
I think they will try and get away with the bare minimum to take it back to Le Mans, because that is basically, you know, if you can only do one race left,
yeah,
obviously it's going to be that one.
Yeah, exactly. But what that means is that we have only 8 cars in LMP1. The 2 Rebellions, Bicolors, 2 Toyotas, Dragon Speed, and SMP. The 7 cars in LMP2, which are the 7 full season entries anyway. I think it is still just the single Ligier and the single Dallara. We've got the 10 GTE Pro cars, of course, and the 9 GTE AM cars. So a little more weighted towards the GT cars now with Mana pulling out. But still, I am really excited to get some proper WEC racing back underway. Like, it's just been too long. 2 months is too long.
But also, we've had this, on the other hand, this bit of a quiet period has been quiet on track, but it's been pretty busy in behind the scenes getting some updates ready, yep, hopefully, for the race.
So there have been a few driver changes. I think Aston Martin has very much changed their driver lineups, with I think Johnny Adams stepping into the amateur cars. Yep, which means that, unfortunately, Ewan Hanke, whose last stint at Spa was friggin' awesome, has been forced out of the WEC car, the GTM car, which is a real shame. But, of course, Aston Martin has to do what they've got to do to be competitive in the class. I think another point of interest is the fact that we have Jenson Button now, who will be racing in the entire remainder of the Super Season as well. So that's pretty cool. After his first race at Le Mans,
they're going to be getting a lot of support at Silverstone.
Oh yeah, that'll be like the fact that they've got Jenson Button, and then also there's just a lot of really good, great British drivers in that LMP1 class, but Jenson Button is certainly a standout. I would say. And then finally, this will be the first sort of opportunity we might see for a few new high downforce kits across the field. I would expect SMP to be racing their high downforce kit to go along with the Dragon Speed high downforce kit. But have we seen any updates from Bicolors or Rebellion on a HDF kit?
So, Bicolis had on the 8th of this month, they tested supposedly a major high downforce update at Spa to then use today, to then use, to use at,
Silverstone.
Got loads of notifications pop up at once, and let me say that again.
Yes.
So Bicolis have been testing at Spa on the 8th of this month, testing a high downforce kit to then hopefully be used at Silverstone. That's obviously subject to it working
and approval
as expected. Because currently, the previous setup for Bicolis has really been leaning towards, in my opinion, leaning towards a Le Mans style spec.
Yep. Cool.
Toyota, hopefully, will be using their only rehomologation to go towards high downforce all the way up until Spa next year. As you said, the SMPs, I expect them to be in the downforce, high downforce kit that we saw on the Dragon Speed at Spa.
Yep.
And Rebellion, they had very good downforce levels at Le Mans.
And at Spa as well.
Which was a very similar setup. A lot of the change was gurney flat height on the rear wing, stuff like that. Will there be a significant update, because they did claim to be using the low downforce Le Mans kit at Spa. So if they have a new one, will they release it? And
it's probably too much downforce, to be honest. Like, if they had another higher downforce set up on top of the one that they had at Spa, which was easily, by miles and miles, the best of the cars in the second sector, they probably just don't need that much downforce.
If anyone can handle it, I think Neil Gianni will be all right, based on his
yeah, good point.
919 Evo driving.
Yeah. Cool. So it's going to be very interesting in the LMP1 class to see how this new EOT fares, and also how the BR1 engineering, the BR engineering BR1 copes with the high downforce kit in race conditions and at the hands of a competent team. Because, of course, we all remember what happened to the Dragon Speed car at Spa-Francorchamps, which meant that they didn't actually start the race. So hopefully we actually get to see a bit more of the high downforce kit and actually see what it's capable of. But, yeah, go ahead.
And that we can also compare the two powertrains that they've got, because they've got the same aero kit on. Yes, there's different setups, changes between those cars, but it gives a nice vague representation.
The perfect kind. So we should actually wrap this up and talk about some predictions. So we'll save the tasty bit to the end. Let's go from GTEM up to LMP1.
So it was my understanding that the BOP is separate at Le Mans.
Yes.
They do it different way. So I was wondering if we revert back to the BOP levels at Spa and in GTEM.
You know what? I actually haven't even seen anything about GT BOP for Silverstone, like, at all.
Exactly. So who were the top two cars in GTEM but were very, very slow at Le Mans?
Aston Martin.
So I've gone for the AMR 98 Aston Martin for the win, despite being the slowest in the previous race.
Damn, you might have just, like, outthought the entirety of everything. I did not even consider that even a little bit. But the thing was, as well, at Spa, the Porsches were just so strong, but all of them ran into problems. I can't look past the Porsche. I just can't do it. Especially coming
off... my number two and number three predictions are
Porsche and Porsche. Yeah.
You got it.
I would have to say the Dempsey Proton number 77, especially seeing as they just won Le Mans as well. I think that's just, they're in such a good stead, and I reckon it'll be them, then the 98, and then one of either TF Sport or the Dempsey Proton car. I reckon they're the next two strongest teams, especially with Johnny Adam jumping into the TF Sport car. Like, that's just a crazy, crazy pickup. I mean, it is a shame that, who was it? Ewan Hankey gets ousted out, but yeah.
My reason for choosing the 98 was because it was between that and the TF Sport car, but potentially driver coming back, the nuances of the old car, getting back up to speed, maybe is why I picked the AMR car over the TF Sport.
Hmm. Good thoughts. Good comprehensive thoughts. You've given me a lot to consider.
I'm going
to
be all wrong.
I mean, yeah, we all are. I mean, that's kind of the fun, right? Why do you think we have these prediction contests and these sort of things? So that way we can pretend to know what we're talking about and then just watch it all go to shit.
It's all for the bragging rights.
Exactly. Bragging rights in GTE Pro, then. If we're going to use your same logic of the Spa beer balance of performance, who does that point to as the top two manufacturers?
Ford and Porsche.
So with that in mind, who do you reckon is going to be the top car in this class?
I've taken a punt on the 67 car because of the home advantage of having a double British driver lineup.
See, if you're American, I'd be pretending to scream the national anthem, but like, I can't even get that passionately, ironically patriotic about England. It's just not a thing that I can do. I'm sorry.
But it's a British team.
Yeah. It's not. It's listed as a USA entry. On the entry sheet. If you want a really British team, you need to go with the Aston Martin 97. But even that's only got one Brit behind the wheel. Do we expect much from Aston Martin and BMW and Ferrari, for that matter, from the look of what we've seen over the past few weeks, even though we've seen nothing?
I'm not so keen on the Aston Martin Pro Cars pace. I think Ferrari's going to be the next best. Behind the Ford and Porsches. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see for that.
I'm actually going to disagree. I reckon BMW are going to be the one nipping at the heels of Ford and Porsche, especially after their recent form in the US. That car has actually been looking more and more strong the more time they get to develop it. So I actually reckon BMW are going to be nipping at the heels, but I would still pick the 91 car with Richard Leitz and Jimmy Bruni as the top car for me. Coming off of Le Mans second place, I wish they still kept the Rothman colours though, man. Can't they just keep them forever? But I still reckon it's just going to be Ford versus Porsche at the top, especially if the balance performance hasn't changed.
That's the key point, yeah. Mm.
Moving onward to the LMP2 class, a bit more variety in here. Who have you gone with for your podium?
I wanted to do another bamboozle, but I'm still not. Am I going to go for it?
You're going to say Racing Team Netherlands, aren't you?
No. They're going to be second last.
But they have Nick de Vries as well this time.
Well, we'll see. Yeah. I'm looking forward to his performance. I wasn't that impressed seeing him live at Silverstone in the support race for the Grand Prix, but I might have been misremembering it.
Fair
enough. But for my LMP2, I'm going to go for the Dragon Speed car because of Anthony Davidson coming in.
Oh, holy crap, what?
It's going to be his LMP2 debut.
No. He is on this... What is he doing? Okay. Yep. That's definitely thrown a spanner in my works.
So, potentially, Pastor Maldonado on the top of a class podium.
That's a scary thought. Damn, that just really does throw just all of the spanners in what I was going to say. I was going to pick the 36, then the 28, then the 31. But the fact that, Anthony Davidson's in that car. I reckon you might be right. I'm going to follow the Dragon Speed car.
Also, it comes down to the tyres there, because they're the ones on the Michelins.
That is also a very good point. It'll be interesting to see how the track temperatures affect the Michelins as opposed to the Dunlops. Especially, it's going to be a bit cooler. Yeah, that's very interesting. And also remember, we don't have G Drive in this class anymore. They've running the rest of the season in the ELMS, so they're actually not a part of the WEC season anymore. So that kind of takes out one of the big players of the game. So yeah, that'll be a very interesting one to keep an eye on. Even though it's seven cars, couldn't be able to predict anything almost. And then finally, LMP1, the money class. Where is your money at? Which Toyota?
Am I going for the Toyotas? Yes, I am.
Yes, yes, you are.
I'm going to pick the number 7 for the win. To balance up, potentially, the two Toyotas. But also, it would be nice to give Conway a home win.
Toyota that nice, though?
No, considering he had gearbox overheating or something at Spa in the last couple of laps to maintain the gap. We'll see. We'll see.
I think it's just going to be a case of whoever's in front at the last stint just gets to win it like it was at Spa. More interestingly, though, pick your top three non-hybrids.
Here we go. I think it's too early to say, seeing as we've not seen that much in terms of high downforce pace. I can't remember that much from Paul Ricard, and they could have had so many updates since in behind the scenes. But based on driving alone, I'm going to go for the number one, Rebellion. Then I'm going to go for the number 11. And then I'm going to go for the number three.
Yep. I would agree that those are three entirely non-controversial picks. I just think the Rebellion car is just going to have the strongest high downforce package. So, and the fact that they're running the Gibson means they get a weight break, and the fact that they're getting that EOT target adjusted, I reckon the Gibson might actually keep Toyota more honest than they did at Le Mans. So I'd also pick the number one. And then it's really just a potluck between what happens next. I actually, like, fingers crossed, I hope the Bicolors team and the S&P team are, like, right on each other's butt for the entire race. I really want to see, like, some actual proper competition in this class.
But also competition all the way through.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the dream scenario would be that you had Toyota maybe, like, 30 seconds, 40 seconds over a race distance ahead, and then all of the other manufacturers within, like, a 10-second bracket. Like, that would be the dream.
Yeah, I agree.
And on that note, I feel like that brings us to the end. Anything you wanted to add before we finish up? Before you actually go to Silverstone? You should go to Silverstone.
It would be interesting to see what if a privateer has the legs on the straights, depending on lift and coast durations required from the Toyotas. For example, going into Stowe Corner, at the end of the straight, the fast right-hander. It'll be interesting to see if there would still be a top speed difference between the two, but we don't know yet based on the drag and downforce levels.
Yep.
It'll be interesting.
Cool. And I'm just really excited to just get some WC back on the box. It's been too long. And on that note, thank you very much for joining me, Trevor Vasaurus.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for listening. And we will see you this weekend, hopefully. Cookie and I will probably do another little preview between the qualifying and the race. And then, yeah, we'll be on to our next race in the super season. Thank you very much. Peace out.